Hi, and welcome to Lakeshore Update. I'm Sarah Dykstra. On this edition of the podcast, you'll hear from Nick Jansen as he reports on an East Chicago lawsuit. Annie Ropeek talks to us about the three-part series, The Ports of Indiana. And regionally speaking, host Chris Nolte talks with Chief Strategy Officer Michael McCall about a barn-shaped hotel Fair Oaks Farms is building. All of that and more on this edition of Lakeshore Update. Valparaiso High School principal quit his job suddenly on Monday, November 6th. Lakeshore Public Radio's Sharon Jackson has the story.
Valparaiso Community Schools Associate Superintendent Dr. Julie Luak said Ammons resigned for personal and professional reasons.
His reasoning for his resignation was to recharge and pursue some other professional and personal options.
Lakeshore Public Radio asked Luak if Ammons resigned for any adverse reasons, such as problems with students.
Not to my knowledge. We're going by what he says in his resignation.
The resignation is effective immediately, and the school board will accept Ammons' resignation at its next board meeting. With the sudden vacancy, school administrators had to do some shuffling of staff.
Right now, we have moved up Dr. Tabone, and she will be the interim principal. And Mr. Allison will replace Dr. Tabone, and he will be interim associate principal. And then we'll be moving someone into the assistant principal to replace Mr. Allison. So we'll get all the holes filled.
Luak says administration will open the position when the time comes and will likely interview for a new school principal by the end of the school year. But in the meantime, Valparaiso Community Schools will conduct business as usual, utilizing its interim team. Valparaiso High School coach Dave Coyle also resigned during the school year on Wednesday, October 25th. Luak says she did not know why the coach left the job, but to her knowledge, it was not related to Ammons' resignation.
I do not have any of that information. I know that he submitted his resignation to Dr. Fratasha, and that too was accepted by Dr. Fratasha.
Luak says she believes the interim principal and the athletic director will begin interviewing for the football coach position by the start of the new year in January. For Lakeshore Public Radio, I'm Sharon Jackson.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update from Lakeshore Public Radio 89.1 FM. I'm Sarah Dykstra. More than 30 East Chicago homeowners last week sued several companies the federal government holds responsible for toxic industrial contamination. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Nick Jansen has more.
The companies include DuPont, Atlantic Richfield, British Petroleum, USS Lead, and Mueller Industries. They're responsible for funding the cleanup of the lead-contaminated Superfund site. Attorney David Chisworth, who represents the residents for free, says in addition to property value decline, residents suffer emotional distress.
When your homes are contaminated with lead and arsenic, and knowing the health problems that are associated with that certainly causes people emotional distress.
Chisworth also says these companies have been absent from years of community cleanup meetings and hopes the lawsuit changes that pattern.
Fear liability is really no excuse for silence or inaction.
A spokesperson for DuPont said in an email the company doesn't comment on ongoing litigation. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Nick Jansen.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update from Lakeshore Public Radio 89.1 FM. I'm Sarah Dykstra. Governor Eric Holcomb wants to create new levels of bureaucracy to better align workforce needs with education and training. Those new levels would replace failed versions created during the Pence administration. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Brandon Smith reports on Holcomb's 2018 agenda.
Holcomb's initiative follows in the footsteps of several previous governors who've tried to match what's taught in schools and training programs with what employers need at their businesses. Holcomb says the new iteration will be locally focused, with leaders at the regional, county, and community level driving decision-making.
Guys like me say, we wish Washington, D.C. would let us tend to our own affairs. Well, sometimes the locals say that about the state.
With that comes a new state government group, the Education to Career Pathway Cabinet. It will be led by Secretary of Career Connections Blair Milo and include leaders from several state agencies and the General Assembly. They will spend the next year helping establish the local groups to focus on workforce alignment. Holcomb says he will empower the new cabinet to shape programming and direct funding across the state. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Brandon Smith at the State House.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update from Lakeshore Public Radio 89.1 FM. I'm Sarah Dykstra. Annie Ropeek reports on a three-part series called The Ports of Indiana. Here's part one. Indiana's ports move millions of tons each year of the stuff that's made and used at Midwest factories. Stuff like steel, grains, and coal. The ports connect Indiana to the fast-changing national and global economies. Today, in the first of a three-part series, Indiana Public Broadcasting's Annie Ropeek tells us how the port of Indiana Burns Harbor has secured its place in the steel industry.
When you picture a port, you might picture water and a dock with a big container ship tied up. Burns Harbor is not that port, but it's the closest thing to it in Indiana, amid steel mills and sand dunes on the shores of Lake Michigan.
My name's Ian Hurt. I'm the port director at the Port of Indiana Burns Harbor.
And where are we right now?
We are in Portage, Indiana, on a lovely day. About to take a tour of the port.
At the water's edge, a loader is scooping some dusty white cargo out of a floating barge. It's a tiny bit of the 8 to 10 million tons of stuff this port moves every year. That's the weight of more than 36 Sears Towers. You can see Chicago's skyscrapers in the distance. Hurt says the minerals in this barge started out on a big ship.
Came across the Pacific, most likely through the Panama Canal, up to New Orleans.
That part can take 25 days.
Got loaded into barges in New Orleans. Those came up the Mississippi River, eventually to the Illinois River.
Through waterways around Chicago.
Out across Lake Michigan, and then into Burns Harbor.
That leg took 3 weeks. Now a truck can take this cargo from China to a warehouse in Ohio. All that wending over water is still the cheapest way per mile to move this stuff long distance. A barge can hold more than 15 times as much as a rail car and 70 times as much as a truck. Put another way,
it costs as much to bring a steel coil from Antwerp, Belgium to Burns Harbor by ship as it does to bring a steel coil from South Bend, Indiana to Burns Harbor by truck.
Steel is a big reason this port exists. Burns Harbor is neighbors with the largest steel mills in the country, and their customers cluster up here to save money buying and moving the raw steel. Minnesota-based Rattner Steel is one of those customers. Its Burns Harbor plant manager, Ryan Molstead, says it can buy steel on port and truck it over or barge it in.
It's all about freight. Just the closer you are to it, the cheaper it is to get it from point A to point B, whether receiving it or shipping it.
The steel business isn't always stable. Global competition and technology have shrunk American mills in recent decades. Molstead says his U.S. suppliers know the port gives Rattner more places to get its raw materials, which keeps prices fair. Another plus for Burns Harbor, access to interstate highways for trucking products out.
So the port is right on the bottom of Lake Michigan, so we can go east. Minnesota, we couldn't go east effectively. As we moved here, we gained a lot of business out in Michigan, Ohio, and we keep going.
Back outside, longshoremen are relieving a big red ship of its cargo, steel beams from Germany. The vessel hails from the Marshall Islands, and Hurt, the port director, says it'll probably go north on the lakes to pick up grain bound for Europe when it's done here.
Basically, as soon as that cargo comes off, they're going to throw off the lines and they're going to hit the marine highway.
The tugboat Arizona is waiting to turn the huge ship around, but right now her captain is asleep on the deck. This pace is typical at Burns Harbor, but soon officials hope their new resident stevedore, Metroports, will bring in more bulk cargoes like those minerals earlier. Steel is still the staple here and throughout Indiana's port system, but in such a volatile industry, it never hurts to diversify. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Annie Ropeek in Portage.
That was part one of the three-part series. Now Annie will take us to Jeffersonville to talk about part two of The Ports of Indiana. Our series on the ports of Indiana went to Burns Harbor, an international maritime facility in the heart of steel country. 4 hours down I-65, the port of Jeffersonville is a less than a port and more of a manufacturing hub that happens to be on the Ohio River. For the next part of our series, Indiana Public Broadcasting's Annie Ropeek reports Jeffersonville is pushing ahead with expansions to cement its place in the Midwest Industrial Corridor.
Indiana's three ports have a few things in common, chiefly grain and barges. Chuck Long of Consolidated Grain and Barge knows a bit about those. He's operations manager here for the huge international company, which collects grain from farmers and barges it to the Gulf of Mexico for export. Long says they also move products for other companies that live at the port.
So think of it as a cul-de-sac in a neighborhood, or the person that moves it around in the neighborhood.
His company is one of the port's stevedores. They pick up products and deliver materials on the roads, docks, and train tracks that connect this place. Soon, they'll have more room to do it. Jeffersonville is adding rail and barge capacity with the help of a $10 million federal infrastructure grant. Officials hope those upgrades will bring in more bulk cargo, stuff you count by weight. But for now, this locomotive is hauling the port's mainstay, steel. That's the business of nearly half the port's tenant facilities. Mike Pavick runs one of them, Michigan-based Mill Steel.
You're going right out that door there.
Yep. Pavick's factory barges in raw steel from the U.S. and beyond and trucks out finished products.
They can use it for furniture. It goes and gets stamped, and they can use it for different parts of auto parts. It can be used for a lot of different things.
Other companies here melt steel from scrap or clean the rust off it using acid. That's called pickling. And they all move their products in different ways, barges, trains, and trucks. Steel Dynamics, based in Fort Wayne, doesn't use the river at all at its Jeffersonville plant. But manager Chris Winger says they're still glad to be part of this neighborhood.
There is a portion of it that's a steel campus. It behaves like a steel campus, right? It just brings various synergies to that whole process of the steel market here in the U.S.
At Winger's factory, miles of steel coils are getting treated for use in construction.
So basically what we do is we take steel coils, right? We run them through a furnace, get them nice and hot, dip the steel in a bath of molten zinc. Comes out of the bath of molten zinc, we cool it off, make it nice and flat, we wrap it back up, we sell it to a customer, or we paint it. That's it in a nutshell.
From steel cargo that never touches the river to this barge being emptied of tons of fertilizer, Port Director Scott Stewart says all this probably wouldn't be here if so much of Indiana's border wasn't, in fact, water.
People don't understand. They think of Indiana as the crossroads of America, very ground transportation oriented, interstate highway oriented, but they don't think about Indiana as being a maritime state. Indeed, it is.
So Indiana may not be coastal, but having both land and water to work with can be useful. And Stewart wants his port to make the most of both. As it adds new rail and barge capacity, he says there's also a search for new tenants to complement what it already has. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Annie Ropeek in Jeffersonville.
That was part two of the three-part series, The Ports of Indiana. Lastly, Annie will take us just outside Evansville to Mount Vernon. In our series on the ports of Indiana, we've seen steel and manufacturing hubs on Lake Michigan and the Ohio River. Today, we go to Indiana's truest river port, Mount Vernon, outside Evansville. It's the highest traffic port in the system, helping move process grain, coal, and more all around the world. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Annie Ropeek reports it's more susceptible than any other state port to the fallout from shifts in federal policy.
There's one commodity at the Port of Indiana Mount Vernon you won't find anywhere else in the system. Alliance Coal spokesman Heath Lovell is showing me an 18,000-ton pile of it.
Can I touch it?
Touch what?
The coal.
Yeah. You can't just touch it. You can have it.
This pile, which is apparently small by normal standards, came from mines in Indiana, Illinois, and Kentucky off trucks and trains that dumped it into pits in the ground. From there, conveyor belts carried it onto this pile or onto barges on the Ohio River to ship out to power plants.
They will take it and they'll put it through a pulverizer and they will turn it into a fine dust. And then they take that and they blow it into the boiler, and it's just like a huge fireball. And then that heats water into steam, and that high-pressure steam turns a turbine, and that's what creates electricity.
Alliance can handle up to 8 million tons of coal a year at this facility, but they aren't selling that much these days. That's why Lovell says their port space is crucial. Using water saves money, and coal needs all the help it can get to be competitive.
So if we're able to have coal be the cheapest option, then the utilities are buying coal, and one of the best ways we can do that is by making sure that we get the transportation cost as low as possible.
Mount Vernon is full of commodities tied to volatile markets, ethanol and soy biodiesel, grains and fertilizer. Steve Onan, vice president of Consolidated Grain and Barge's soybean processing plant here, says it means they're closely watching policy changes, from support for biofuels to the renegotiation of trade deals such as NAFTA, which has heavily benefited many farmers.
If those borders were closed or there were tariffs that were put into place that were harmful to agriculture, that would have a ripple effect all the way back to southern Indiana, which we do not want to happen.
Port Director Phil Wilsbacher says he always points to food to show the impact of the port and the policies affecting it.
Relating back to the everyday person who goes to the grocery store and buys a can of Jif peanut butter, you can trace it back here to soybean oil being produced at this plant.
But grain and fuels aren't all Mount Vernon handles these days. In fact, Wilsbacher says today's port is likely far beyond what state officials imagined when they built the system 40 years ago.
You know, the access to the Ohio River, it was primary, was key. But the rail service is as key. The road access is as important. And that is something that gives the port its ability to be successful as having that connectivity to all three modes.
Indiana's other ports have that connectivity too, and they've used it to attract something Mount Vernon is largely missing, a heavy steel or manufacturing base. Wilsbacher wants that to change. Mount Vernon is bigger and has more land open than the other two ports, including a parcel almost the size of all of Burns Harbor. Officials are shopping the space around to site selectors and economic developers. They've put the port's name in on a dozen different projects just this year.
The manufacturing is one area that I look to, you know, an opportunity to promote. You know, it's an ongoing discussion internally of how do we better market ourselves.
Indiana's mainstay industries could add some stability at this port in case political will ever turns against the things that helped it grow. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Annie Ropeek in Mount Vernon.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update from Lakeshore Public Radio 89.1 FM. I'm Sarah Dykstra. Vice President Mike Pence made his second official visit to Indiana in a month, Thursday, November 9th, for a roundtable discussion with Governor Eric Holcomb, Senator Todd Young, and a group of small business owners. Indiana Public Broadcasting's and WFYI's Drew Daudelin reports Pence used the trip to continue a push for bipartisan support on tax reform.
The vice president says the administration wants to lower taxes on working families, small businesses, and family farms. Pence claims if the GOP plan passes, Hoosier workers could expect a raise of $4,000 a year. Pence says there's momentum in Washington to get reform passed, but during his speech, he applied pressure to Indiana Democratic Senator Joe Donnelly.
We need the support of every Hoosier in Congress. I know we're going to be able to count on Senator Todd Young, but Indiana also needs to be able to count on Senator Joe Donnelly to vote for tax relief for the people of the Hoosier State.
Earlier in the day, Senator Donnelly met with a White House official to talk about the Senate's new tax reform proposal. He says in a statement that he will carefully review it and stay engaged with his colleagues. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Drew Dudlin.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update from Lakeshore Public Radio 89.1 FM. I'm Sarah Dykstra. Employees of the University of Notre Dame will still have access to no-cost birth control after the end of the year through a third-party provider. IPBS's Jennifer Weinhardt has more.
Notre Dame announced last week it would no longer provide coverage to employees. Their health care provider, Meriton Health, announced it will continue to offer the coverage at no cost to plan members. The university had been party to a lawsuit challenging the Affordable Care Act mandate that required no-cost contraceptive coverage. The result of the suit allowed Notre Dame to offer the coverage through a third-party health care provider instead of directly. A recent decision by the Trump administration allowing for exemptions to the birth control mandate for religious or moral reasons enabled the university to drop the coverage altogether. Meriton Health announced it will continue to offer coverage funded by the ACA to Notre Dame plan members. In an email to employees, Notre Dame says while it follows Catholic teachings about the use of contraceptives, it recognizes the plurality of religious and other convictions among its employees and will not interfere with the provision of contraceptives that will be administered and funded independently of the university. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Jennifer Weingart.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update from Lakeshore Public Radio 89.1 FM. I'm Sarah Dykstra. Eye on the Arts host John Kane talks with Phil Potempa, Marketing Director for Theater at the Center, about their upcoming It's a Wonderful Life performance. Here's that conversation.
Joining me for this edition of Eye on the Arts is Phil Potempa, Marketing Director for Theater at the Center at the Center for Visual and Performing Arts in Munster. Welcome back, Phil.
Thank you, John.
So what are we going to talk about today?
We have so many wonderful opportunities for the holidays at the Center for Visual and Performing Arts and Theater at the Center. And I say wonderful because our big holiday production run is A Wonderful Life, the musical being performed.
Is this the first time that Wonderful Life is being performed?
You know, it's such a favorite story, and I think about how the movie used to be shown over and over and over, I think, before Ted Turner got his hands on it. And we have done it before, but not as much as the TV viewings have been of the classic movie. Mm-hmm. Last time was about 10 years ago, so it's time to revisit George Bailey and the family.
Absolutely. I'm sure it was a hit when it was on the stage before.
It is. Yeah. And it's, again, it's the musical telling of it. So you get the advantage of some wonderful songs, and it's a little bit of a slight change for a couple of the things in the story. But for the most part, all the favorite characters are there, including Old Man Potter and everybody else, including also Clarence getting his wings. So all those classic moments are there.
So there is a local connection?
There is, and you probably know this. You're probably just being kind to me. But if the folks
I'm
that
not.
Are – you're not, okay. Usually I don't get a chance to teach John Kane something, but this is a learning moment here. Everybody always thinks about our Christmas holiday movie being – a Christmas story being the only one with a connection with right. Hammond. But it's the Wonderful Life, you know, of the movie with Jimmy Stewart. Beulah Bondi, who played his mother and was so fantastic in there, she's a Valparaiso University graduate and was born and raised in Valparaiso and got her start in Little Lord Fauntleroy on the Memorial Opera House stage. So she really is an actress as our local claim to fame in Northwest Indiana, and of course thought of by many as the mom of George Bailey in the movie It's a Wonderful Life.
Well, I'm going to have to bone up on my Beulah Bondi.
That's right. See?
I feel like I've been shirking my duty as an arts person. Okay, Beulah Bondi it is. I'm going to be IMDBing
That's
her.
That's it. That's my gift to you, John,
Thank
today.
Thank you so much. So who's directing this production?
The wonderful William Polinzi, who spent 10 years at Theater at the Center as artistic director. Mm-hmm. He was back last spring for that fantastic run we did of Nice Work If You Can Get It. And mm-hmm. so now we have him for the holidays, and he'll be doing what's going to be a very lavish production of A Wonderful Life, the musical.
Well, that's fantastic. Bill was a long-tenured director and the inventor of dinner theater in
that's
Chicago.
Right. Yes.
So he should do a bang-up job on this show. And you have some special holiday dinner nights?
Yeah, I just want to remind folks, because this is the time of year where people maybe only see one show a year. We hope you come and see more. But we also have this fantastic holiday buffet. It's a show package, a great price. It's two times, December the 7th and December the 15th. One-stop shopping. Come in the evening, have a wonderful buffet meal created from the Chef Trauma right there at the Performing Arts Center, and then come and see the show afterwards.
And you have a special New Year's Eve bash
yes.
too, right?
That's become a tradition for so many folks. And our New Year's Eve celebration is, once again, two performances. For the early birds that want to be in bed before the ball drops, 6 p.m. performance is going to be our salute. The Four Seasons do their salute to Frankie Valli and the Four Seasons. And then for the Night Owls, the 10 p.m. performance. And we're all right there to raise a glass and see in the new year.
So is that a combination of food and theater?
It is, exactly. You can do just the show only, but the dinner buffet is such a great package. Just add that on and great
yeah.
price. And just again, you're right there under one roof and no driving or worrying about parking. And again, you get home safe.
Yeah. I think my technique for dealing with the ball dropping is to set an alarm. Go to bed when I feel like set an alarm for 1:45.
It's the only moment that matters.
Yeah. And then I'm like, ooh, whoop. It's all so exciting. And then right back to bed. What else is happening that we should know about at the Arts Center?
I just want to make sure I remind everybody that we also have all these special concerts and events. And something new this year is the fact that we have Lightwire's A Very Electric Christmas. And you've seen it on all the different reality shows since America's Got Talent. And again, they're in black suits. They're illuminated with lights all over them. They do this fantastic choreographed musical performance. And it certainly will brighten up your holidays. And that's a lot of performances on the 29th of December and the 30th. So you've got performances both days, four performances to pick from.
That sounds interesting. A Very Electric Christmas. That's very cool. Yeah,
I can say as seen on TV.
As seen on TV.
That's right.
And now you can see it live.
That's right.
Well, that's great. Well, thank you, Phil, for being here to tell us about all of the holiday activities coming up. And we have the Festival of Trees
yes.
in the lobby at the Arts Center throughout December. And that's gorgeous trees that have been designed by local florists and also nonprofit organizations.
Favorite tradition.
Yeah, that's great. It makes the center a really pretty place to visit at that time of year. Okay, well, thanks for being here, Phil. And thank you for listening. We'll be back again next week with another edition of Eye on the Arts.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update from Lakeshore Public Radio 89.1 FM. I'm Sarah Dykstra. Fair Oaks Farms in Newton County is building a new addition to the agritourism destination. A $15 million Fairfield Inn and Suites on campus along I-65. Chief Strategy Officer Michael McCall says it is a uniquely built addition to the current restaurant and conference center. The new hotel should be completed in early 2019. McCall talked with us about it.
We're following the market. The more we add attractions and things to do at Fair Oaks Farms, the longer the potential length of stay is for our guests, because there's just more to do. You know, many of them said, you know, we'd love to be able to stay overnight, you know, right here and take it in another day or take it in a full day and then move on to, you know, elsewhere in our travels. And then the second piece of it is listening to the market of meeting events. We have a lot of facilities at Fair Oaks Farms. A lot of, we have, of course, the farmhouse, restaurant, pub, and conference center has a conference center. But then we have a whole array of other facilities around the campus for meetings from as small as, you know, 5 or 6 people to, you know, to 30 people. And then the farmhouse can have hundreds. So that was another thing is we have these facilities, but it would be great. People told us it'd be great to have a place to stay. So we feel like we're just sort of, you know, beginning to round out the experience and the hospitality with this new Marriott Fairfield Inn and Suites.
Now, what interested you folks in attracting Marriott among all the other companies that offer the similar types of lodging?
We did, you know, research the industry and everything. Marriott is the biggest and the best. It's really the strongest reservation system, and you just can't go wrong. And Marriott, I can't say enough about how good it has been to work with them, because they understood the opportunity to, while living up to all their standards, to make this a very special place that, you know, a bespoke design specifically for Fair Oaks Farms, so that it not only fits in, but it actually extends the identity of Fair Oaks Farms. Mm-hmm. And they've been really terrific to work with.
If you will describe what the architects working for the company have come up with on how the new hotel is going to look when it's finished.
I'd love to do that. It's you know, in a sense, it's a giant red barn, and it's been designed to fit in very well with the farmhouse, restaurant, pub, and conference center, which it'll be connected to. Mm-hmm. So that's a very key thing, is that it'll be physically connected 100 feet away in an enclosed, air-conditioned, heated connection with a lot of windows going by the oaks of Fair Oaks. There's a beautiful tree right there. It is this giant barn and a milking parlor scaled building. The milking parlors are generally one-story structures attached to, you know, the barns with the cattle and the hay barn loft above. Well, we have a smaller building that is integral to the whole hotel. That is our health club and swimming pool. So it really has the model of a classic, if a bit giant, dairy barn.
Now, I know that this is a project, of course, from a national company when you're talking about Marriott, but you have a lot of Northwest Indiana players that are involved in this at almost every aspect of the planning as well as the construction. Go down the list and tell us about all the companies and businesses that are going to be involved to help make this actually become reality for Fair Oaks Farms.
We sure do have a lot of help from Northwest Indiana. First, it starts out with good hospitality services. They own and or manage 25-plus hotels, so they know this industry extremely well, and they have guided us through the process of working with Marriott and in the design, and they will actually manage the hotel. We have Core Construction out of Schererville. It's a national company, but this is their a very strong office right here, just 20 miles away from the farm. Mm-hmm. And we have DBG Civil Engineering taking care of the stormwater management and all those things and making that look beautiful as well as functional. We've got the Hamster Group is one of the largest subcontractors to Core, and they've built many things at the farm already and are very strong in this area. So we've got a great complement of regional talent coming to bear for us, and we greatly appreciate that.
When you all got together to do the initial planning before the big announcement of the creation of this this great lodging facility that's going to be built along part of the Fair Oaks Farms campus, what ideas did they have? What kind of comments did they have that they wanted to make this, and it certainly is going to turn out that way based on the designs that we've seen so far, to make this a truly unique experience along the same lines as what the entire Fair Oaks Farms complex has really been over the years, hasn't it?
Well, thank you for saying that. All of us wanted to make this, a very special hotel that has the reputation and quality of a Marriott, but is completely unique. And it faces Interstate 65, and you will be able to. We have two silos attached like a barn would. We have these two large silos. And those silos create, there's two silos and four floors in the hotel. So we have eight opportunities to have some very unique rooms. And those eight silo suites will be very special. We have four of them. We call them family and friends. They'll have bunk beds. We have two of them that will be have a one-room conference center, meaning a place for four, five, six people to meet for a meeting right in the room, added on to a conventional room with all the AV support and everything. And then we have something really special, which we have, we call it the bridal boudoir, which is, a bridal suite so that the bride and the maid of honor and her mom and all of her girlfriends can get ready for a great wedding event that day. So it's a very unique hotel, and the team has, everybody's contributed to the ideas of how to make that unique.
Now, Michael, we have the big announcement of the plans for this this great facility to be built. What's the timetable? When are we likely to like to reserve a room and actually enjoy this this great hotel? It's a few years down the road, but not that far away, I understand.
Yeah, it's about a year and a half. So we will be open for business, we believe, in February of 2019. So we've got about a year and a half. The construction, we had our groundbreaking last Thursday, of course, but the construction's actually started about a month before that. They're busy pouring foundations right today, and so far things are going very well. And if we can get it open sooner than February, we will, but right now that's what we're saying, February 2019.
Michael McCall, thanks very much for being with us to tell us about this great event coming up here, and looking forward to watching the project move along the way there along I-65. Thanks for talking about it.
Thank you so much.
Michael McCall is the Chief Strategy Officer for Fair Oaks Farms. Again, Fair Oaks Farms is celebrating the construction of the Fairfield Inn and Suites by Marriott that's going to be going on the Fair Oaks Farms campus there along I-65 in Newton County. For Lakeshore Update, I'm Chris Nolte.
Regionally Speaking with host Chris Nolte can be heard each Monday through Thursday on Lakeshore Public Radio 89.1 FM and streaming online at lakeshorepublicradio.org, where you can also find podcasts of the show when you click on the program's link. For the latest in local news and information, tune in Monday at 6 a.m. for Morning Edition with local host Chris Nolte. Lakeshore Update is supported by the listeners and members of Lakeshore Public Radio 89.1 FM. Podcasts for Lakeshore Update are posted each Friday on our website, lakeshorepublicradio.org, as well as on NPR One. Make sure to search for WLPR and select us as your home station. Music for Lakeshore Update was written and produced by BenSound.com. For Lakeshore Update, I'm Sarah Dykstra.